to have to witness other people's, to have to try and manage theirs too. He couldn't deal with my tears. I remember. I remember. "Thank you," I said. He nodded, his back still turned. Everything was there, obvious to us both, but it all remained unsaid. Sometimes that was best. After he'd gone, I put the sweater on. It was far too big, of course, but that made it even better, with more of it to go around me any time I needed it. Sammy's parting gift. Chapter 36. Getting to Dr. Temple's office involved a bus journey into town and then a short walk. My travel pass had expired, and it was symptomatic of my general feeling of Weltschmerz, of anomie, that I hadn't even bothered to renew it last week. Marianne. Everything else was just trivia. I dropped £2 into the driver's slot, caring not one whit that it bore an ugly sticker saying, "No change given," and that I had therefore needlessly sacrificed 20 pence. Who gave a fig about 20 pence when it came down to it? All of the seats already had an occupant, which meant I was going to have to position myself next to a stranger. In a different mood, I enjoyed this game. One had 10 seconds to scan the occupants and select the slimmest, sanest, cleanest-looking person to sit next to. Choose wrongly, and the 15-minute journey into town would be a much less pleasant experience. Either squashed beside a sprawling fatty, or mouth-breathing to minimise the penetration of the reek emanating from an unwashed body. Such was the excitement of travelling on public transport. I took no pleasure in the game today, however, and merely seated myself as close to the front as possible, taking no interest in the merits or demerits of my companion. As luck would have it, she was an elderly woman, slightly on the plump side but not inconveniently so, who smelled of hairspray and kept herself to herself. Good. She got off at the next stop, and then I had the seat to myself. More people got on, and I watched a handsome young man, tall, slim, with disproportionately large brown eyes, play the scanning game in order to select a seat. I looked forward to sitting next to him, being sure that he was neither mad nor malodorous. However, he walked straight past me and sat on the other side of the bus, next to a short, rough-looking man in a sports jacket. I couldn't believe it. Two people got on at the next stop. One went upstairs, and the other, once again, eschewed the spare seat next to me and walked towards the back of the bus, where, I noticed when I turned around to look, she seated herself next to a man with no socks on. His bare ankles looked distressingly white above his ox-blood leather brogues, which he had teamed with green jogging bottoms. A madman. I stared at the floor, my mind racing. Did I look like the kind of person who ought to be avoided in a game of bus seat selection? I could only conclude, in the face of the evidence, that I did. But why? I would have to reason my way to the answer. I wasn't overweight, I didn't smell, I showered daily and I laundered my clothes regularly. That left madness, then. Was I mad? No. No, I wasn't. I was suffering from clinical depression, but that was an illness. It wasn't madness. Did I look mad then? Act mad? I didn't think so. But then how would I know? Was it my scar, my eczema, my jerkin? Was it a sign of madness even to think you might be mad? I rested my elbows on my knees and placed my head in my hands. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. "You all right, Hen?" a voice said. And I felt a hand on my shoulder, causing me to startle and sit up again. It was the man with no socks, who was en route to the front of the bus. "Yes, thank you," I said, not making eye contact. He sat down next to me while the bus approached the next stop.
"You sure?" he said kindly.
"Yes, thank you," I repeated. I risked a look at his face. He had very gentle eyes, the same delicate shade of green as newly emerged buds on trees.
"Just taking a wee moment, Hen."
He patted me on the arm.
Everybody needs to take a wee moment to themselves now and again, eh?
He smiled full of warmth and stood up to leave. The bus was slowing down.
Thanks, I called after him.
He didn't look round but raised a hand in salutation, trousers riding up past his bare ankles as he left. He wasn't mad. He just didn't have any socks on. Eleanor, I said to myself, sometimes you're too quick to judge people. There were all kinds of reasons why they might not look like the kind of person you'd want to sit next to on a bus, but you can't sum someone up in a 10-second glance. That's simply not enough time. The way you try not to sit next to fat people, for example. There's nothing wrong with being overweight, is there? They could be eating because they're sad, the same way you used to drink vodka. They could have had parents who never taught them how to cook or eat healthily. They could be disabled and unable to exercise, or else they could have an illness that contributes to weight gain despite their best efforts. You just don't know, Eleanor, I said to myself. The voice in my own head, my own voice, was actually quite sensible and rational, I'd begun to realise. It was Mummy's voice that had done all the judging and encouraged me to do so too. I was getting to quite like my own voice, my own thoughts. I wanted more of them. They made me feel good, calm even. They made me feel like me. Chapter 37. Old routines, new routines. Perhaps even sometimes no routines. But twice a week, for as long as it was going to take, I made the journey to town. Avoided that old lift and climbed the stairs to Dr. Temple's consulting room. I no longer found it nasty. I was beginning to understand the efficacy of neutral, unattractive surroundings, tissues, chairs and an ugly framed print. There was nothing else to look at, save oneself. Nowhere to retreat to. She was smarter than she first appeared, Dr. Temple. That fact notwithstanding, her dreamcatcher earrings today were frankly abominable. I was about to take to the stage and say my piece. I wasn't acting, though. I'm a terrible actor, not being by nature a dissembler or a faker. It's safe to say that Eleanor Oliphant's name will never appear in lights, and nor would I want it to. I'm happiest in the background, being left to my own devices. I've spent far too long taking direction from Mummy. The subject of Marianne had caused me so much distress, me trying furiously to build up my courage and direct my memory into places it didn't want to go. We'd agreed not to force it, to let her appear naturally, we hoped, as we talked about my childhood. I'd accepted this. Last night, as Glenn and I listened to the radio, the memory, the truth of it, had come to me, quite unbidden. It had been a perfectly ordinary evening, and there was no fanfare, no drama, just the truth. Today was going to be the day I spoke it aloud, here, in this room, to Maria. But there had to be some preamble. I couldn't just blurt it out. I'd let Maria help by leading me there. There was also no escaping Mummy in the counselling room today. It was hard to believe that I was actually doing this, but there it was. The sky didn't fall in. Mummy wasn't summoned like a demon by the mere mention of her name. Dr. Temple and I were, quite shockingly, having a reasoned, calm conversation about her. "Mummy's a bad person," I said. "Really bad. I know that. I've always known that." And I wondered, do you think I might be bad too? People inherit all sorts of things from their parents, don't they? Varicose veins, heart disease. Can you inherit badness? Maria sat back, fiddled with her scarf. That's a very interesting question, Eleanor. The examples you gave are physical conditions. What you're talking about is something different, though. A personality, a set of behaviours. Do you think that behavioural traits can be inherited? I don't know, I said. I thought about it. I really, really hope not. I paused for a minute. People talk about nature and nurture. I know I haven't inherited her nature. I mean, I'm a
difficult person sometimes, I suppose. But I'm not like her. I don't know if I could live with myself if I thought I was like her.
Maria Temple raised her eyebrows.
Those are very strong words, Eleanor. Why'd you say that?
I couldn't bear it if I thought that I would ever actually want to cause someone pain, to take advantage of weaker, smaller people, to leave them to fend for themselves, to...
I broke off. It had been very, very hard to say that. It hurt. A real physical pain, as well as a more fundamental existential ache.
For goodness sake, existential ache, Eleanor, I said to myself. Get a grip.
Maria spoke gently. But you're not your mother, are you, Eleanor? You're a completely separate person, an independent person, making your own choices. She gave an encouraging smile. You're still a young woman. If you wanted to, you could have a family of your own one day and be a totally different kind of mother. What do you think about that?
That was an easy one. Oh, I'll never have children, I said, calm, matter of fact.
She indicated that I should keep talking. It's obvious, isn't it? I mean, what if I passed it on, the mummy thing? Even if I don't have it, it could skip a generation, couldn't it? Or what if it's the act of giving birth that brings it out in a person? It could be lying dormant all this time, waiting.
She looked very serious. Eleanor, I've worked with several clients over the years who've had similar worries to yours. It's normal to feel that way. Remember, though, we've just been discussing how different you are from your mother, the different choices you've made. But Mummy's still in my life, even after all this time. That worries me. She's a bad influence, a very bad influence.
Maria looked up from the book where she was taking notes. You're still talking to her, then? She said, her pen poised.
Yes, I said. I clasped my hands and took a deep breath. But I've been thinking that it needs to come to an end. I'm going to stop. It has to stop.
She looked as serious as I'd ever seen her.
It's not my role to tell you what to do, Eleanor. I will say this, though. I think that's a very good idea. But ultimately, it's your decision. It's always been your decision, she said, excessively calm and ever so slightly aloof. It was as though she was trying just a bit too hard to be neutral, I thought. I wondered why.
The thing is, even after everything that she's done, after all of it, she's still my mummy. She's the only one I've got. And good girls love their mothers. After the fire, I was always so lonely. Any mummy was better than no mummy.
As I paused in tears, I saw that Dr. Temple was completely sympathetic, that she understood what I was saying and was listening without judgment.
Lately, I said, starting to feel a bit stronger, a bit braver, buoyed by her kind eyes and supportive silence. Lately, though, I've come to realise that she's just bad. She's the bad one. I'm not bad, and it's not my fault. I didn't make her bad, and I'm not bad for wanting nothing to do with her, for feeling sad and angry. No, furious about what she did.
The next bit was hard, and I looked at my clasped hands as I spoke, scared to see any change in Dr. Temple's demeanour in response to the words coming out of my mouth. I knew that something about her was very, very wrong. I've always known, as long as I can remember. But I didn't tell anyone. And people died. I dared to look up, and felt my body slump with relief when I saw the expression on Maria's face, unchanged.
Who died, Eleanor? She said quietly.
I took a deep breath.
Marianne, I said. Marianne died.
I looked at my hands, then back at Maria.
Mummy set a fire. She wanted to kill us both, except somehow Marianne died, and I didn't.
Maria nodded. She didn't look surprised.
Had she already worked it out? She seemed to be waiting for me to say something else, but I didn't. We sat in silence for a moment.
"It's the guilt, though," I said, whispering.
It was very hard to speak, physically hard, trying to force out sound.
"I was her big sister. I should have been looking out for her. She was so small. I did try, I really did, but it's just... it wasn't enough. I failed her, Maria. I'm still here, and that's all wrong. It should be her who survived. I don't deserve to be happy. I don't deserve to have a nice life when Marianne..."
"Eleanor," she said gently, once I'd calmed myself. "Feeling guilty about surviving when Marianne didn't is a perfectly normal reaction. Don't forget you were only a child yourself when your mother committed her crime. It's very important that you understand that it's not your fault, that none of it was your fault." I was sobbing again. "You were the child and she was the adult. It was her responsibility to look after you and your sister. Instead, there was neglect and violence and emotional abuse, and there were terrible, terrible consequences for everyone involved. And none of that is your fault, Eleanor. Absolutely none of it. I don't know if you need to forgive your mother, Eleanor," she said. "But I'm certain of one thing. You need to forgive yourself." I nodded through the tears. It made sense. I wasn't sure that I quite believed it yet, but it certainly made logical sense, and you can't ask for more than that. Blowing my nose, unembarrassed by the trumpeting, which was as nothing compared to the horrors I'd already laid before Dr. Temple in this room, I made my decision. It was time to say a final goodbye to Mummy. Chapter 38. Raymond had insisted on meeting outside the counselling rooms that day to take me for coffee. I watched him amble towards me. His peculiar loping walk was almost endearing now. I wouldn't recognise him if he started to walk as normal men did. He had his hands in the pockets of his low-slung denim trousers and was wearing a strange oversized woolen hat that I hadn't seen before. It looked like the kind of hat that a German goblin might wear in an illustration from a 19th-century fairy tale, possibly one about a baker who was unkind to children and got his comeuppance via an elfin hoard. I rather liked it.
"All right," he said. "I nearly froze my bollocks off on the way over here."
He blew into his cupped hands. "It is rather inclement today," I agreed, "although it's wonderful to see the sun." He smiled at me.
"It is, Eleanor."
I thanked him for taking time off to come and meet me. It was kind of him, and I told him so.
"Away you go, Eleanor," he said, putting out his cigarette. "Any excuse for a half day. Anyway, it's nice to talk to someone about something that isn't software licenses and Windows 10.
"But you love talking about software, Raymond," I said, sniffing. And then I nudged him in the ribs, very gently, very bravely. He laughed and nudged me back.
"Guilty as charged, Miss O," he said.
We went into a branch of a cafe chain. I'd seen lots of them around town. We queued and I asked for a grande mochaccino with extra cream and hazelnut syrup. The young man asked my name. "Why do you need to know my name?" I said, puzzled.
"We write it on your cup," he said, "so the drinks don't get mixed up."
Ridiculous. "Well, I haven't heard anyone else order an identical drink to mine so far," I said firmly. "I'm sure I'm more than capable of identifying my chosen beverage when the time comes." He stared at me, the pen still poised in his hand.
"I have to write your name on the cup," he repeated,
sounding firm but bored, as people in uniform are often wont to do. "And I have to maintain a modicum of privacy by not sharing my given name with all and sundry in the middle of a cafeteria," I said, equally firmly. Someone further back in the queue tutted, and I heard someone else mutter something that sounded like, "for fuck's sake." It appeared that we had reached something of an impasse. "Fine, all right then," I said,
My name is Miss Eleanor Oliphant. He boggled at me.
I'll just put, Ellie, he said, scribbling.
Raymond was silent, but I could feel his large shoulders and misshapen body quivering with laughter. It was his turn next.
Raoul, he said,
and then spelled it out. When we'd collected our drinks, with no problem whatsoever, we sat at a table in the window and watched people pass by. Raymond stirred 3 sachets of sugar into his Americano, and I resisted the urge to suggest that he made healthier choices.
So,
he said, after what I recognised was a comfortable silence.
How did it go today?
I nodded. It was okay, actually, I said. He looked closely at me.
You look like you've been crying, he said.
I have, I told him, but it's fine. It's normal to cry when you're talking about your dead sister. Raymond's face contorted with shock. She died in the house fire. Mummy started it on purpose. We weren't meant to survive, but somehow I did. My little sister didn't, though, I said. I sounded strangely calm as I said these words. I looked away when I'd finished, knowing that Raymond's face would be expressing emotions that I wasn't quite ready to relive yet while he processed this information. He started to speak, but struggled. I know, I said calmly, giving him a minute to compose himself. It was a lot for anyone to take in. It had taken me decades, after all. I told him a bit more about what had happened to Marianne, about what Mummy had done. Now that I've finally been able to talk about what she did to me and what she did to Marianne, I can't possibly continue to have Mummy in my life. I need to be free of her. He nodded.
Does that mean you're going to...
Yes, I said. Next Wednesday. Next time I speak to her, I'm going to tell her that we're done. It's time to cut contact for good. Raymond nodded, almost approvingly. I felt calm, sure of the way forward. It was a novel sensation. There's something else I need to do, too. I need to find out everything that happened to me, to us, back then. I remember some of the details, but now I need to know all of it. I cleared my throat. So, will you help me, Raymond? Help me find out what happened? The fire? I said, not looking at him, my words barely audible. Please? Asking for help was anathema to me. I told Maria that. And how's that been working out for you so far? She'd said. I didn't appreciate her somewhat pointed tone, but she was quite right. That didn't, however, mean that it was easy.
Of course, Eleanor, he said. Anything. Whenever you're ready, whatever you need.
He took my hands in his and squeezed them gently. Thank you, I said, quiet, relieved, grateful.
I think it's amazing what you're doing, Eleanor, he said, looking at me.
This is what I felt. The warm weight of his hands on me, the genuineness in his smile, the gentle heat of something opening the way some flowers spread out in the morning at the sight of the sun. I knew what was happening. It was the unscarred piece of my heart. It was just big enough to let in a bit of affection. There was still a tiny bit of room left.
Raymond, I said. You can't know how much it means to me to have a friend. A genuine, caring friend. You saved my life, I whispered, scared that tears might come here in the cafe and embarrass us both.
Now that I'd started crying in public more often, it seemed that I would do it at the drop of a hat. Raymond squeezed my hands tighter, and I fought, and won over, the urge to whip them away and put them behind my back.
Eleanor, don't thank me. You do the same for me, you know you would.
I nodded. To my surprise, I realised that he was right.
I remember the first time I met you, he said, shaking his head and smiling. I thought you were a right nutter.
I am a right nutter, I said, surprised that he'd think otherwise. All my life people had been telling me that. No, you're not, he said, smiling. Aye, sure, you're a bit bonkers, but in a good way. You make me laugh, Eleanor. You don't give a fuck about any of the stupid stuff. I don't know, being cool, office politics, or any of the daft shite that people are supposed to care about. You just do your own thing, don't you? I was crying now. There was no avoiding it. Raymond, you swine, I said. You've made my smoky eyes dissolve. I was quite annoyed when I said it, but then I started to giggle, and he laughed too. He passed me one of the cafe's inferior paper napkins, and I wiped off the dark remnants. You look better without it, he said. Afterwards, we walked towards the point where we'd parked in search of our respective bus stops. See you soon, then, he said. Oh, you'll be seeing me sooner than you think, I said, smiling at him. What do you mean? He looked puzzled and mildly amused. It's a surprise, I said, gesturing with my hands and shrugging extravagantly. I'd never seen a magician perform on stage, but that was the look I was trying for. Raymond burst out laughing. I'll look forward to it, he said, still smiling as he fumbled in his pockets for his cigarettes. I took my leave of him in a somewhat distracted frame of mind, my thoughts returning to Marianne and to Mummy. I had work to do now. The past had been hiding from me, or I'd hidden from it, and yet there it was, still lurking in darkness. It was time to let in a little light. Chapter 39. Back to work. A cockerel's dawn crowing had woken me back from my slumbers. This glorious morning sound was powered by an AA battery and delivered through a tinny speaker, and was brought about by my setting my alarm clock the previous evening, rather than, as is the case in our avian friends, raised levels of testosterone and sunlight. It is fair to say that my bedroom is a testosterone and sunlight-free zone at present. But winter does pass, I told myself. Remember that, Eleanor. Glenn was slumped over my feet on top of the duvet, keeping them warm as she did her best to ignore the alarm. Excited at the prospect of the day ahead, I dressed in a new white blouse, a new black skirt, black tights, and the boots I'd got a while ago for a gig I should never have gone to. I looked smart, practical, normal. Yes, I was going back to work. Years ago, one of the foster families I lived with had taken me, alongside their own children, on a back-to-school shopping trip. All three of us were allowed to choose new shoes and a new school bag, and were kitted out with a brand new uniform, even though my skirt and blazer from the previous year still fitted perfectly well. Best of all, the trip culminated with a visit to W.H. Smith, where the riches of the stationery aisle were ours to plunder. Even the most recondite items, set squares, butterfly pins, treasury tags, what were those for, were permitted, and this booty was then zipped into a large, handsome pencil case which was mine, mine, mine. I am not generally a wearer of perfume, preferring to smell of plain soap and my natural musk, but were it possible to purchase a bottle in which the scent of new pencil shavings and the petroleum reek of a freshly rubbed eraser were combined, I would happily douse myself with it on a daily basis. I ate breakfast, porridge and a plum, as usual, and left in good time to catch the bus. Glenn was still asleep, having moved under the duvet to occupy the warm space as soon as I vacated it. I left her some fresh water and a big bowl of kibble, but I doubted she'd even notice I'd gone until she heard my key in the lock again tonight. She was very easygoing that way, although not, it had to be said, in lots of other ways. The walk to the bus stop was more interesting than I remembered, perhaps because I was seeing it with fresh eyes after such a long absence. There was an excessive amount of litter, and no litter bins. Those two facts were surely correlated. This part of the city was aggressively grey, but green life still struggled into being. Moss on walls, weeds and guttering, the occasional forlorn tree. I've always lived in urban areas, but I feel the need for green as a visceral longing. Just as I was about to reach the junction where I crossed to catch the bus, I stopped dead.
my eye drawn to a sly movement, a measured dash of brownish red. I breathed in, the morning air cold in my lungs. Under the orange glow of a streetlight, a fox was drinking a cup of coffee. He wasn't holding it in his paws, as has been clearly established, I'm not insane, but rather had dipped his head to the ground and was lapping from a Starbucks cup. The fox sensed me watching, looked up and stared assertively into my eyes. "What of it?" he seemed to be saying. "A morning cup of coffee, big deal." He went back to his beverage. Perhaps he'd had a particularly late night out by the bins, was finding it hard to get going on this cold, dark morning. I laughed out loud and walked on. While I'd been off, Bob had told me to pop into the office any time, or phone for a chat whenever I wanted. Last week, a few days before my sick note was due to expire, I was still undecided as to whether to revisit the doctor and seek an extension, or else return to work on the following Monday, so I had called him, not wanting to go into the office for fear of encountering intrusive questions from my co-workers without having prepared some appropriate responses first.
"Eleanor," Bob had said, "great to hear from you. How are things?"
"Thank you for the flowers," I said. "I'm fine. That's to say, I'm much better, thank you, Bob. It's been difficult, but I've been making good progress."
"Brilliant," he said. "That's brilliant news. So do you know when you're likely to be back?"
I heard an intake of breath as he worried about what he'd just said.
"No rush now, no rush whatsoever. I'm not pressuring you. Take as long as you need, not until you're absolutely ready."
"Don't you want me to come back, Bob?" I said, daring an attempt at humour. He snorted.
"Eleanor, the place has been falling apart without you. Jesus Christ, Billy hasn't the first clue how to raise an invoice, and as for Janie..."
Bob, I was joking," I said. I smiled, and I must admit to feeling slightly gratified at how poorly my colleagues had coped in my absence.
"A joke, Eleanor? Well, that's a great sign. You must be on the mend then,"
Bob said, sounding relieved, either because of the joke or because I was getting better, or both, I supposed. "I'll be back on Monday, Bob," I said. "I'm ready." My voice was firm, confident.
"Great. And you're sure it's the right time?" "Oh, that's grand, Eleanor," he said. "I'll look forward to seeing you on Monday, then."
I could tell he was being genuine because of all the warmth that was coming down the phone. Your voice changes when you're smiling. It alters the sound somehow. "Thank you very much for being so understanding about all of..." "About everything, Bob," I said, a lump forming in my throat. "Thank you for your support. I've been meaning to say... I'm sorry if I haven't always been a very enthusiastic employee over the years."
"Ugh, away you go," he said, and I could almost picture him shaking his head. "The place wouldn't be the same without you, Eleanor. It really wouldn't. You're an institution."
I heard his mobile phone ringing. He tutted. "I'm so sorry, but I've got to get this, Eleanor. It's a new client. Now you take care of yourself and we'll see you on Monday, right?" "Right," I said. I remember thinking as I put the phone down that I really, really hoped that Janie wouldn't bring in one of her homemade cakes to mark my return, as she often did when people had been off. Dry doesn't even come close to describing the arid desert texture of her coffee and walnut sponge. When I arrived at work, the exterior of the office was as unenticing as ever, and I hesitated outside. I had been absent for almost 2 months, and heaven alone knew what sort of unsubstantiated rumours had abounded as to the reasons behind it. I had not given, had not been capable of giving, a thought during that time to my spreadsheets, to accounts receivable, purchase orders and VAT. Could I still do my job? I wasn't confident that I could remember anything. My password? Of course. 3 words. Ignis aurum probat. Fire tests gold. The rest of the phrase, and adversity tests the brave. How true. A strong password. Strong indeed. exactly as required by the computer system. Thank you, Seneca. Ah, but I felt the beginnings of a fluttery panic in my chest. I couldn't do it, could I? I wasn't ready to face it. I would go home and telephone Bob, let him know that I'd be taking another week's leave. He'd understand. There was a shuffling sound behind me on the path, and I quickly wiped away the tears that had formed while I was staring at the squat building before me. With no warning, I was pulled 180 degrees around and crushed into an embrace. There was a lot of wool, hat, scarf, gloves, and scratchy bristles and a smell of apples, soap, and Marlboro Reds.
"Eleanor," Raymond said, "so that's what you meant when you said you'd see me soon."
I let myself be held, moved closer into the embrace, in fact, because I was forced to admit, at that particular time and in those particular circumstances, and feeling the way I did, the sensation of being held by him was nothing short of miraculous. I said nothing, and very slowly my arms crept up, tentative as winter sunlight, so that they were placed around his waist, the better to bury myself into the embrace. My face rested against his chest. He said nothing either, intuiting perhaps, that what I needed most at that moment was that which he was already providing, and precisely nothing more. We stood this way for some moments, and then I stepped back and rearranged my hair, wiped my eyes. I looked at my watch. "You're 10 minutes late for work, Raymond," I said. He laughed.
"So are you."
He stepped forward again, peered closely at me. I stared back at him, rather like the fox had done earlier. He nodded.
"Come on," he said, holding out his arm. "We're both late now. Let's go in. I don't know about you, but I could really do with a cup of tea, eh?"
I linked my arm through his and he walked me inside, all the way to the door of the accounts office. I disengaged from him there as quickly as I could, anxious that someone might see us together like this. He bent down and put his face close to mine, speaking in a rather paternal manner. At least I assume that's what it was. Fathers are hardly my area of expertise, after all.
"Now then," he said, "here's what's going to happen. You're going to walk in there, hang up your coat, put the kettle on, and get started. No one's going to make a fuss, and there won't be any drama. It'll be like you've never been away."
He nodded once as if to reinforce his point. "But what if..."
He spoke over me. "Honestly, Eleanor, trust me. It's going to be absolutely fine. You've been unwell, you took some time off to get better, and now here you are, back in the fray. You're great at your job, and they'll be over the moon to have you back. End of," he said. Earnest, sincere, kind.
I did actually feel better after he said this. Quite a bit better.
"Thank you, Raymond," I said quietly. He punched me on the arm, gently, not a real punch, and smiled. "We're so late," he said, eyes wide in faux horror. "Meet you for lunch at one?" I nodded. "Go on then. Get in there, give 'em hell," he said, smiling. And then he was off, lumbering upstairs like a circus elephant learning a new trick. I cleared my throat, smoothed down my skirt, and opened the door. First things first. Before I went to my desk and faced everyone, I had to have the dreaded back-to-work interview. I'd never had one before, but I'd heard the others muttering about them in the past. Apparently HR forced you to have a meeting with your boss if you'd been off for more than a couple of days, ostensibly to make sure you were fully recovered and fit for work, and to see if any adjustments needed to be made to ensure you stayed well. In reality, however, the popular view tended towards this process having been designed to intimidate, to discourage absence, and to check whether you'd been, what was the word? Oh yes, skiving. Those people didn't have Bob as a boss, however. Only the section managers reported to Bob. I was one of them now. The Praetorian Guard, the elect. Bob was an odd kind of emperor, though. He stood up and kissed me on the cheek, and while he hugged me, his little pot belly pressed against me and made me want to laugh. He patted my back a few times.
The whole thing was excruciatingly embarrassing, but really, really nice. He made me a cup of tea and fussed around with biscuits, making sure I was comfortable.
Now then, this interview, it's nothing to worry about, Eleanor, a formality. HR give me a hard time if I don't do these things, you know what it's like.
He made a face. We just need to ticky-boxy.
What?
And sign the form, and then I'll let you get back to it. He was slurping from a mug of coffee and had spilled some down his shirt front. Bob wore thin shirts, a vest visible beneath, which added to the overall impression of an overgrown schoolboy. We went through a list of insultingly banal prescribed questions from a form. It was, to the visible relief of us both, a painless, if somewhat tedious, process.
Right then, he said. That's that done, thank Christ. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about? It's a bit soon to get into specifics, I know, he said. We can meet again tomorrow when you've had a chance to get up to speed with everything, if you like.
The Christmas lunch, I said. Is it all arranged now? He screwed up his little round face and swore in a most uncherubic fashion.
I totally forgot about that, he said. There were so many other things to sort out, and it just kind of, I don't know, slipped off my radar. Oh, shit.
Fear not, Bob, I said. I shall address it post-haste.
I paused. I mean, after I've caught up with all the accounts, of course.
Bob looked worried.
Are you sure? I really don't want to put any extra pressure on you, Eleanor. You're just back, and I'm sure you'll have more than enough on your plate.
No problemo, Bob, I said confidently, giving him a double thumbs-up sign, thereby trying out a favourite phrase and gesture of Raymond's for the first time. Bob's eyebrows shot up. I hoped I had used them correctly and in the appropriate context. I'm very good with words, as a rule, but this sort of thing does, I must confess, trip me up sometimes.
Well, if you're 100% sure, he said, not, it must be noted, sounding particularly sure himself.
Absolutely, Bob, I nodded. Everything will be confirmed and arrangements put in place by the end of the week. You can count on it.
Ah, well, that'd be brilliant, he said, scribbling on the form which he then passed to me.
I just need you to fill in that section at the bottom, and that's us done, he said. I signed with a flourish. I don't have much opportunity to use my signature in day-to-day life, which is rather a pity, as I have a very interesting John Hancock, as our cousins across the pond would have it. I don't mean to boast. It's just that almost everyone who's seen it has remarked on how unusual, how special it is. Personally, I don't see what all the fuss is about. Anyone could write an O as a snail shell spiral if they wish to, after all. And using a mixture of upper and lowercase letters is simply good sense. It ensures that the signature is difficult to forge. Personal security, data security, so important. When I finally sat down at my desk, the first thing I noticed was the flowers. They'd been obscured by the monitor as I'd approached, but now I saw the vase. Well, it was actually a pint glass. The office never had enough vases, cake knives or champagne flutes, despite employees celebrating life events on what seemed to be a weekly basis. It was filled with blooms, sea holly and agapanthus and iris, and it was glorious. An envelope was propped against the arrangement, and I slowly opened the seal. There was a card inside, a stunning photograph of a red squirrel eating a hazelnut on the front. Inside, someone, Bernadette, I suspected from the childlike scrawl, had written, "Welcome back, Eleanor," and a multitude of signatures, accompanied by best wishes or love, were scattered across both sides. I was somewhat taken aback. Love? Best wishes? I wasn't at all sure what to think. Still mulling this over, I switched on my computer. There were so many unanswered emails that I went straight to today's, thinking that I'd simply delete all the others. The senders would get in touch again if they were important, surely. The most recent one, sent only 10 minutes ago, was from Raymond. The subject heading read, "Read me."
Thought I'd better put that as you probs have about 10 billion unread messages in your inbox right now, LOL.
I meant to say the other afternoon, I've got 2 tickets to a concert. It's classical music. I don't know if you like that sort of thing, but I kind of thought you might. It's 2 weeks on Saturday if you're free. Maybe go for something to eat afterwards. See you at lunch. R.X.
Before I had a chance to reply, I realised that my colleagues had assembled in a circle around my desk without my noticing. I looked up at them. Their expressions ranged from bored to benevolent. Janie looked mildly concerned.
"We know you don't like a fuss, Eleanor," she said, having clearly been nominated as spokeswoman. "We just wanted to say that we're glad you're feeling better and, you know, welcome back."
There were nods, murmured assent. As speeches went, it was hardly Churchillian, but it was yet another very kind and thoughtful gesture. I wasn't one for public oratory, but a sense that they would not be satisfied without a few words. "Thank you very much indeed for the flowers and the card and the good wishes," I said, eventually, eyes on my desk while I spoke. There was a bit of silence that no one, and certainly not me, quite knew how to fill. I looked up at them. "Well," I said, "I don't suppose those overdue invoices are going to process themselves, are they?"
"She's back," Billy said, and there was laughter, including my own. Yes, Eleanor Oliphant was back.
Chapter 40. Wednesday night. High time. "Hello, Mummy," I said. I heard my own voice. It sounded flat, emotionless.
"How did you know?"
Sharp, irritated. "It's always you, Mummy," I said.
"Cheeky! Don't be insolent, Eleanor. It doesn't suit you. Mummy doesn't like naughty girls who talk back. You know that."
Old ground, this. A reprimand I'd heard so many times before. "I don't really care what you like anymore, Mummy," I said. I heard her snort, short, derisive.
"Oh, dear, someone's in a strop. What is it? Time of the month? Hormones, darling? Or something else? Let me see. Has someone been filling your head with nonsense? Telling lies about me? How many times have I warned you about that? Mummy isn't..."
I interrupted. "Mummy, I'm going to say goodbye to you tonight." She laughed.
"Goodbye? But that's so final, darling. There's no need for that. Come along now. What would you do without our little chats? What about your special project? Don't you think you ought to keep Mummy updated on your progress at least?"
"The project wasn't the answer, Mummy. It was wrong of you, very wrong of you, to tell me that it was," I said. "Not sad, not happy, just stating facts." She laughed.
"It was your idea, as I recall, darling. I merely cheered you on from the sidelines. That's what a supportive mummy would do, isn't it?"
I thought about this. Supportive. Supportive meant... what did it mean? It meant caring about my welfare. It meant wanting the best for me. It meant laundering my soiled sheets and making sure I got home safely and buying me a ridiculous balloon when I was feeling sad. I had no desire to recount a list of her failings, her wrongdoings, to describe the horrors of the life we'd led back then, or to go over the things she'd done and not done to Marianne, to me. There was no point now. "You set fire to the house while Marianne and I were asleep inside. She died in there. I wouldn't exactly call that supportive," I said, trying my best to keep my voice calm, not entirely succeeding.
"Someone has been telling you lies. I knew it," she said, triumph in her voice.
She spoke brightly, full of enthusiasm.
"Look, what I did, darling, anyone would have done the same thing in my situation. It's like I told you, if something needs to change, change it. Of course there will be inconveniences along the way. You simply have to deal with them and not worry too much about the consequences."
She sounded happy, glad to be dispensing advice. She was, I realised, talking about killing us, Marianne and me, her inconveniences. In a strange way, it helped. I took a breath, although I didn't really need to. "Goodbye, Mummy," I said. The last word. My voice was firm, measured, certain. I wasn't sad, I was sure. And underneath it all, like an embryo forming, tiny, so tiny, barely a cluster of cells, the heartbeat as small as the head of a pin, there I was. Eleanor Oliphant. And just like that, Mummy was gone. Better Days. Chapter 41. Although I felt completely fine and, indeed, ready to get back into the thick of it all, HR had insisted on a phased return, whereby I only worked during the mornings for the next few weeks. More fool them. If they wished to pay me a full-time salary for part-time hours, it was their lookout. At lunchtime on Friday, the end of my brief working day and my first week back, I met Raymond for the second time that week. Since then, we'd been communicating solely by electronic means. I had spent the previous evening searching online. It was so easy to find things. Too easy, perhaps. I printed 2 newspaper articles without reading beyond the headlines, then sealed them in an envelope. I knew Raymond would have found them already himself, but it was important to me that I did the searching. It was my history, and no one else's. No one else alive, at any rate. As requested, he joined me in the cafe so that I wasn't alone when I read them for the first time. I tried to cope alone for far too long, and it hadn't done me any good at all. Sometimes you simply needed someone kind to sit with you while you dealt with things.
"I feel like a spy or something," said Raymond,
looking at the sealed envelope that lay between us.
"You're completely unsuited to a career in espionage," I told him. He raised his eyebrows.
"Your face is too honest," I said, and he smiled.
"Ready then," he said. "Serious now." I nodded.
The envelope was a buff manila self-sealing A4, which I had purloined from the office stationery cupboard. The paper had come from there too. I felt slightly guilty about it, especially since Bob, I knew now, had to factor this sort of thing into his running costs. I opened my mouth to tell Raymond about the stationery budget, but he nodded towards the envelope encouragingly, and I realized that I could delay matters no further. I eased it open, then held it towards him to show him that there were 2 pages of A4 inside. Raymond shuffled even closer, so that we were touching, sides together, congruent. There was warmth and strength there, and gratefully, I drew on it. I started to read. The Sun, 5th of August, 1997, page 2. "Pretty but deadly kiddie killer fooled us all, neighbours say. Killer mum, Sharon Smythe, pictured, 29, had been living in a quiet Maidervale street for the last 2 years, neighbours said, before deliberately starting the fire that ended in tragedy. She was such a pretty young woman, she had us all fooled," said a neighbour, who did not wish to be named. "Her little ones were always properly turned out, and they spoke so nice. Everybody said what lovely manners they had," he told our reporter. "As time went on, you could tell something wasn't right, though. The kiddies always seemed terrified of her. Sometimes they had bruises, and people heard a lot of crying in that house. She'd go out a lot. We just assumed there was a babysitter, but looking back on it... One time I was talking to the older girl. She was only 9 or 10, I'd say, and the mum shot her such a look that she started to shake, trembling like a little dog. I dread to think what went on in there behind closed doors. Police confirmed yesterday that the fatal blaze at the property had been started deliberately. A child, 10, who cannot be named for legal reasons, remains in hospital, in a critical condition." I looked at Raymond. He looked at me. Neither of us said anything for a while.
"You know how it ends, right?"
Raymond said, gentle, quiet, looking me in the eye. I pulled out the second article. London Evening Standard, the 28th of September, 1997, page 9. Maida Vale murder latest. Two dead. Plucky orphan recovers. Police confirmed today that the bodies recovered from the scene of last week's Maida Vale house fire belong to Sharon Smythe, 29, and her youngest daughter Marianne, 4. Her eldest child, Eleanor, 10, was released today from hospital after making what doctors described as a miraculous recovery from third-degree burns and smoke inhalation. The spokesman confirmed that 29-year-old Smythe started the fire deliberately and died at the scene as a result of smoke inhalation as she fled the property. Tests on both children revealed that a sedative had been administered and provided evidence that they had been physically restrained. Our reporter understands that Eleanor Smythe initially managed to free herself and escape the blaze. Neighbours then reported seeing the badly injured 10-year-old re-entering the house before the emergency services arrived. Firefighters allegedly found her attempting to open a locked wardrobe in an upstairs bedroom. The body of her 4-year-old sister was recovered inside. Police have been unable to trace any living relatives of the child, who is being cared for by social services.
"That's all I found too," Raymond said,
as I pushed the printouts towards him. I looked out of the window. People were shopping, talking on mobiles, pushing prams. The world just went on, regardless of what happened. That's how it works. Neither of us spoke for a while.
"Are you okay?"
he said. I nodded. "I'm going to keep seeing the counsellor. It helps." He looked at me carefully.
"How do you feel?"
he said. "Not you as well," I sighed, and then I smiled so that he would know I was joking. "I'm fine. I mean, yes, obviously, I've got a lot of things to work through, very serious things. Dr. Temple and I are going to keep talking about all of it. Marianne's death, how Mummy died too, and why I pretended for all those years that she was still there, still talking to me. It's going to take time, and it's not going to be easy," I said. I felt very calm. "Essentially, though, in all the ways that matter, I'm fine now." "Fine," I repeated, stressing the word because at last it was true. A woman jogged past, running after a chihuahua, shouting its name in an increasingly anxious tone. "Marianne loved dogs," I said. "Every time we saw one, she'd point and laugh, then try to hug it." Raymond cleared his throat. More coffees came and we drank slowly.
"Will you be okay?" Raymond said.
He looked angry with himself. "Sorry, stupid question. I just wish I'd known sooner," he said.
"I wish I could have helped more."
He glared at the wall, looking as though he was trying not to cry.
"No one should have to go through what you've been through," he said, finally, furious. "You lost your little sister, even though you tried your best to save her, and you were only a child yourself. That you could come through that, all of that, and then spend all those years trying to deal with it on your own, it's..."
I interrupted him. "When you read about monsters," I said, "household names, you forget they had families. They don't just spring from nowhere. You never think about the people that are left behind to deal with the aftermath of it all." He nodded slowly. "I've requested access to my files from social services now. I've had cause to review my opinion of the Freedom of Information Act, Raymond, and let me tell you, it's actually a splendid piece of legislation. When it arrives, I'm going to sit down and read it cover to cover. The Bumper Book of Eleanor. I need to know everything. All the little details. That's going to help me. Or depress me. Or both." I smiled, to show him I wasn't worried, and to make sure that he wasn't worried either.
"It's more than that, though, isn't it?" he said. "All those lost years, wasted years. Terrible things happened to you. You needed help back then, and you didn't get it. You've got a right to it now, Eleanor."
He shook his head, unable to find the words. "In the end, what matters is this. I survived. I gave him a very small smile.
I survived, Raymond, I said, knowing that I was both lucky and unlucky, and grateful for it.
When it was time to leave, I noticed